remember about the shooting, if you're willing to talk about that.
I was there, but I don't remember the exact moment. I don't remember pulling my gun out of my body or whatever it was located, and I don't remember aiming it at any human being. I don't remember any of that, Mr. President. And I've said that from the get-go.
So I'm trying to evade. No, I understand. Let me just ask you a question. When did you start remembering things after the shooting? What was the first thought that you had after the shooting?
Everything was always hazy in my head about that. And Attorney Teeter, who passed away, was trying to get a specialist, Dr. Herbert Spiegel in New York, to hypnotize me and to regress me and to do all that.
But when did you start remembering things clearly after the shooting?
I really don't remember things clearly about it, other than that.
I'm not asking about the shooting part. I'm asking afterwards. When did you start remembering things in reality?
In reality, all the reality of this whole thing hit me when I was on death row facing my own
death. So how many months later was that?
I would say maybe a year, 2 years.
So you don't remember a lot of things between the shooting and being on death row?
I wasn't too much worried about that, Mr. President. I was worried about saving my own butt from execution.
One of the things that we look at in your case here, and every case is different, was the crime itself. And this indeed, there is, I mean, every murder, which is predominantly what we deal with, is horrible. Certainly to the individual and to the perpetrator, that being the inmate. It certainly is horrible to the family. The individual's, you gotta listen here, guys. Individuals lose in a very dramatic, fast way a loved one that can never be replaced. But this crime went far beyond that, and we need to recognize that. Mr. Kennedy was a winning candidate in California, as you know. I'm repeating things we already know. And there was a groundswell that was a very popular groundswell for the hope that he gave some people, a lot of people. So indeed, it wasn't just the Kennedy family, which was certainly large enough and prominent enough to be of a tragic nature. There was a loss prior to that. There was indeed. You're not going to talk in the middle of my. You're going backwards here, and you need to stay on track and just listen. I'm giving you our reasons for that.
If I was to give you a piece of paper and a pencil, and I wrote down 1, 2, and 3, and I said, make a list of the people that maybe you feel that you've harmed, who would be number one on the list?
Well, definitely the Kennedy family and the Kennedys. I would say that I would treat them all equally, and the victims who were injured in this, and the public, and the Bobby Kennedy's friends, and the people who voted for this whole thing was it's a horrible nightmare, really, for not just for me, but for you people, and for the whole country, and especially for the family members, and Mr. Wiesel and the others who were injured in this.
Thank you. The Lone Nuts. MKUltra was fully operational when Luis Castillo was programmed. It was active the same decade when events blamed on three lone assassins changed the course of history. In a well-executed mass indoctrination campaign employing all the honor, prestige, and power of the U.S. government, Americans were told over and over again that the lives of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy were all taken by the lone assassins. Men operating without political motivation. These three assassins, Lee Harvey Oswald, James Earl Ray, and Sirhan Sirhan, who you just previously just heard, conveniently left diaries, underlinings in various books, and other self-incriminating clues to establish their guilt. The evidence gathered on the assassinations remains fragmented and incomplete. Any event of such magnitude as a political assassination is bound to invite a large number of interpretations. While in 1978, when the first edition of this book appeared, there was not any conclusive proof of a conspiracy. More than 80% of the American public then believed there was a conspiracy. Today, after Oliver Stone's masterful film JFK, more than 90% of the public believe that JFK was murdered by conspirators working within U.S. intelligence agencies. While Congress did cite Richard Helms for contempt and declared the FBI and the CIA did not cooperate with the Warren Commission, the murders of Kennedy, and King remain unsolved mysteries in the public's opinion. A string of circumstantial evidence and knowledge of the fundamentals of mind control invites further speculation. In each case, the method was the same, death by the bullet. In each case, the circumstances were the same, murder in a public place in view of many witnesses. All three assassins were men whose personal histories can be interpreted to indicate they were mentally unstable. Evidence suggests all three had been hypnotized at one time or another. But the similarity in their psychological profiles and the coincidence of each having left a trail of evidence did not seem suspicious to the government investigators of the assassination. That three assassins from three different parts of the country, with three different ethnic backgrounds, and three different victims in three different cities, could all have had the same modus operandi did not seem improbable to the investigators. Those coincidences did not even warrant their notice. A good detective would immediately have suspected that the MO of each assassin was a cover laid down by a professional hit team. The cryptocracy, which grew up after World War II, was compound of a cadre of professionals trained during war. Professional intelligence agents in both the KGB and the CIA are trained to stick to the cover story that works and use it as long as it does work. Even if the cover story is blown, the agent is supposed to stick to it and, if necessary, die with sealed lips. The lone nut theory that the assassins of King and the Kennedys acted alone and the evidence planted to support that theory stand out as a typical professional intelligence cover. The modus operandi, or method of a murder, is the first of two major clues detectives use to solve crimes. Second clue is the motive. Those who support the lone nut theory point to the fact that no clear political motive could be attributed to any of these three assassins. Yet even to a casual student of history, each of the three murders was an obvious political benefit to the extreme right. John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were all independent thinkers who could not be bought off. They worked for expanded civil rights in a manner the right wing interpreted as being communist. It involved government legislation of civil rights. The Church Committee investigation clearly showed that J. Edgar Hoover had a personal vendetta against Dr. King, and it has been reported that he lost no love for the Kennedy brothers. The Kennedys were not only on the wrong side of Hoover's FBI, they were on the wrong side of the CIA as well. JFK fired several top intelligence officers, he asked for Alan Dulles's resignation, and at the time of his death, he was privately talking about reorganizing the entire U.S. intelligence service. Robert Kennedy, as Attorney General, was waging a tireless campaign against organized crime. His campaign cut across the alliances the CIA had formed with gangsters who had lost their gambling and drug possessions in Cuba. Robert Kennedy was a close friend of Dr. King, and one rumor persists that the assassins had issued a dire warning to RFK not to run for president, and that the king was sacrificed to show the group meant business. A similar threat was issued against Ted Kennedy when he was entering presidential thoughts. Robert Kennedy's knowledge of the CIA mafia link and the CIA assassin teams might have been a motive behind the motive, assuming fanatical right-wing operators were contracted for executive actions against the three. The obvious results of all three assassinations would indicate the extreme right-wing, known to be widespread in the cryptocracy, had the most to gain. By their deaths, the civil rights movement was severely crippled, the conflict in Vietnam escalated, and the corrupt leaders of the cryptocracy stayed in power. In the late 70s, a rumor was put forth by CBS News and others that Castro and/or the KGB were behind the assassinations. That theory smells like more disinformation from the cryptocracy. The motives of the communists seem less clear than the motives of misguided, patriotic, right-thinking Americans. The cryptocracy was in better position to benefit from the death of three charismatic and humanitarian leaders than were the communists. Following the assassination of President Kennedy, his successor appointed a now-notorious commission to investigate the crime. Headed by Chief Justice Earl Warren, it included Senator John Sherman Cooper, Senator Richard Russell, Representative Hale Boggs, Gerald R. Ford, former CIA Director Alan Dulles, and John J. McCloy. After 9 months of deliberation, the Warren Commission concluded Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone, had shot President Kennedy. Although Oswald was in turn assassinated by Dallas thug Jack Ruby, and although Ruby's connections with organized crime and the anti-Castro movement were well known, the commission found no evidence of a conspiracy. The 26 volumes of evidence which made up the commission's final report left so many questions unasked that by December 1976, a Harris survey concluded 80% of the U.S. population did not believe the commission's conclusion. From the beginning, the investigation was slanted towards proving Oswald was guilty and had acted alone. The commission had proceeded with haste to put at rest forever the question, was there a conspiracy behind the Kennedy assassination? In its haste, it had overlooked key facts and ignored witnesses who did not support the foregone conclusion that there was no conspiracy, that Oswald was just a lone nut. Throughout the Warren Commission hearings, there was conflicting testimony about Oswald. There was testimony that Oswald did not drive a car. There was other testimony that he did drive, and very well. Some of his acquaintances said he was a poor shot, too poor to have accomplished the feat of a marksmanship in Dealey Plaza. Others said he was a fine marksman. Some said by turns he was a communist, a pro-Castro, and an anti-Castro sympathizer. His own mother said he performed undercover work for the U.S. government. Out of this mass of conflicting evidence, the Warren Commission simply took what was needed to support its foregone conclusion and regaled to rest to published transcripts or to top secret files in the National Archive. There were so many conflicting descriptions of Oswald that many independent assassination investigators subsequently concluded there must have been at least two Oswalds, the real one and intelligence double. If, however, one considers that Oswald might have been controlled in the same way as Candy Jones or Luis Castillo, split into multiple personalities, another explanation for some of the conflicting descriptions of the assassination becomes credible. He might have been an excellent shot in his one zombie state, and in another, he might have been blocked so that he could not even aim a rifle. In one state, he might have had the ability to drive a car, while in another state, he might have had a post-hypnotic block so he could not drive. Oswald said he didn't kill anybody. His statement was recorded in the basement of the Dallas police station on the day after the assassination. Captured on film by a local CBS film crew, Oswald told reporters, "I positively know nothing about the situation here. I would like to have legal representation." In answer to an inaudible question from one reporter, Oswald said, "Well, I was questioned by a judge, however I protest at that time, that I was not allowed legal representation during that very short and sweet hearing. I really don't know what the situation is about. Nobody has told me anything, except that I am accused of murdering a policeman. I know nothing more than that. I do request someone to come forward to give me legal assistance." "Did you kill the president?" asked radio reporter Jerry Kunkel. "No," Oswald answered. "I have not been charged with that, In fact, nobody has said that to me yet. The first thing I heard about it was when the newspaper reporters in the hall asked me that question. 10 years after Oswald made that statement, George O'Toole applied a newly developed truth detector, the Psychological Stress Evaluator, the PSE, to the soundtrack of the film which recorded Oswald's protestation of innocence. The PSE, unlike the polygraph, does not have to be connected to the body to measure stress. It measures subaudible microtremors in the human voice which occur whenever an individual experiences even mild anxiety or stress. The microtremors form a distinct pattern on the PSA chart and can then be compared to stress patterns in other parts of the statement. A deliberate lie, especially one which involves personal jeopardy, stands out clearly from other stress patterns that might represent situational stress or vague anxiety. Oswald was in a situation of high stress that day. He had been grilled for hours by the police. He had been manhandled and accused of killing not only a police officer, but also the President of the United States. Yet, the PSE analysis of Oswald's statement showed he exhibited far more stress when he was talking about not being represented by a lawyer than he did when he denied murdering the President or the police officer. George O'Toole concluded, as many have, other investigators, that Oswald was innocent. He could not have been consciously involved in the assassination of a fall guy, a patsy, or he would have shown stress in his answers to these key questions on the PSE. But when, if he had been hypnoprogrammed so he could remember nothing of his involvement in the assassination plot, then every lie detector test in the world would prove him innocent, since consciously his would believe that he was innocent. Hypnosis is the only reliable way to defeat a lie detector, whether it be a polygraph or the more advanced PSE. Posing as a look reporter, former CIA employee O'Toole conducted and recorded interviews with local police officials and FBI men who were the original investigators in the Kennedy case. Too many of their PSE patterns showed levels of stress which could only be interpreted as having been the result of willful deception. In his book, The Assassination Tapes, O'Toole offers the details of his PSA analysis and concludes, not surprisingly, that there was a conspiracy behind the assassination of JFK. Among the evidence concealed from the commission was a CIA document obtained under the Freedom of Information Act in 1976, which quoted, "An unidentified CIA officer reported to his superiors on Oswald." According to that memo, which had been written only 3 days after JFK's assassination, agency official had discussed interviewing Oswald for intelligence purposes in the early 1960s. The same document revealed that Alan Dulles had secretly coached the CIA on how the agency should deny having any connection with Oswald. According to one of the memos, Dulles strongly recommended CIA Director Helms deny under oath that the CIA had any material in its files which suggested an ad agency relationship with Oswald. Later disclosures revealed Oswald did indeed have a CIA, quote, 201 file. In sworn testimony before the Warren Commission in 1964, Richard Helms applied the artful deception which came from a lifetime of CIA training. He testified the agency had never even contemplated making any contact with Oswald prior to the assassination. That the CIA did make contact with him was never disclosed to the commission. Despite the attempts of Alan Dulles to steer commission investigators away from other information which linked Oswald to both the FBI and CIA, the rumor that Oswald had been sent to Russia as an intelligence agent persisted. In an attempt to scotch that rumor, Dulles told the commission it would be impossible for anyone to prove or disprove that Oswald had or had not been an agent or informer. He said, astonishingly, that Oswald could have been a CIA agent without anyone knowing about it. During one meeting of the commission, Senator Russell asked Dulles, if Oswald never had assassinated the president and had been an employee of the FBI and somebody had gone to the FBI, would they have denied he was an agent? Oh yes, the CIA chief replied. They would be the first to deny it. Your agents would have done the same thing, Senator Russell asked incredulously. Exactly, Dulles answered. At another juncture, John J. McCloy said he had received several inquiries about the Oswald agent rumor. He asked Dulles point blank, "What is there to this story?" Dulles went in circles. "This is a terribly hard thing to disprove, you know. How do you disprove a fellow was not your agent?" "You could disprove it, couldn't you?" Congressman Boggs asked. Dulles replied simply, "No." "So while I'll ask you," Boggs continued, "did you have agents about whom you had no record whatsoever?" "The record might not be on paper," Dulles said, "but on paper would have been hieroglyphics that only two people would know they meant, and anybody outside the agency would not know, and you could say this meant the agent, and somebody else could say it meant another agent." The discussion then turned to a U-2 pilot, Francis Gary Powers. Dulles explained Powers was a different kind of agent. He had signed a contract with the CIA. Alluding to the Oswald-CIA relationship, Boggs asked Dulles, "Let's say Powers did not have the agent signed contract, but was recruited by someone in the CIA. The man who recruited him, would you know, wouldn't he?" "Yes," Dulles replied, "but he wouldn't tell." "Would he tell it under oath?" Chief Justice Warren wondered. "I wonder the think he would tell it under oath." "No," Dulles replied, matter-of-factly. "Why?" asked Warren. "He ought not to tell it under oath," Dulles said, offering Warren a lesson which years of legal training made him incapable of learning. "The cryptocracy operates completely outside of the statutory law, and because of the power of the national security rationale, it operates completely above the law." Dulles admitted later, while responding to a question from McCloy, that a CIA operative might not tell the truth even to his own superior. "What you do," Boggs indignantly said, "is you make your own problem. If this be true, utterly impossible, you say this rumor that Oswald was a CIA agent can't be dissipated under any circumstances." "I don't think it can," Dulles admitted, "unless you believe Mr. Hoover and so forth and so on, which probably most of the people will." Hoover, of course, had written a carefully worded response to a commission inquiry about Oswald's FBI connections. He denied all association between Oswald and the FBI. Also ignored by the Warren Commission was information about the cryptocracy's attempt assassination Fidel Castro. Dulles presumably knew about the plots which took place during the tenure with the agency, but he remained mute. Richard Helms was the only CIA official on active duty to have direct contact with the Warren Commission, and although he provided them with information on a number of things, he volunteered nothing about the unsuccessful plots against Castro, plots which would have been within the Commission's need to know since they showed the cryptocracies had practical experience in assassination planning. Testifying before the Senate Select Committee to study governmental operations with respect to intelligence activities, Helms revealed how the cryptocracy evaded and withheld information from the Warren Commission. His testimony illustrated the cryptocracy's contempt for the helpless commission, the American people, and above all, the truth. During the Church Committee's investigation of the CIA's involvement in assassinations, Senator Church asked Helms, "Since you had knowledge of the CIA involvement in these assassination plots against Castro, and knew it at the time, I would have thought that ought to have been related to the commission because it does bear on the motives or whatever else." Mr. Alan Dulles was a member of the Warren Commission, and the first assassination plot happened during his time as director. What he said to the Warren Commission about this, I don't know, but at least he was sitting right there in the commission's deliberations and knew about this, and I'm sure the same thought that occurred to you must have occurred to him. Senator Morgan, you were charged with furnishing the Warren Commission information from the CIA, information that you thought was relevant. Helms said, "No, sir. I was instructed to reply to inquiries from the Warren Commission for information from the agency. I was not asked to initiate any particular thing." Morgan, in other words, if you weren't asked for it, you didn't give it. Helms, that's right, sir. Nevertheless, despite the denials of Dulles and Hoover, the rumor persisted that Oswald had defected to Russia on a clandestine mission for the CIA. Some believed he had been undercover by the KGB and subsequently programmed like the Manchurian Candidate to return to the U.S. and act as an unconscious sleeper agent, a programmed assassin. Following up on this rumor, J. Lee Rankin, General Counsel of the Warren Commission, wrote a letter to CIA Director Helms requesting all information the CIA had on Russian brainwashing capabilities. In response, Helms claimed that there were major methods of altering or controlling behavior, and the Soviets were interested in both. He said the first was psychological and the second was pharmacological. The two may be used as individual methods or for mutual reinforcement, Helms wrote. For long-term control of large numbers of people, the former method is more promising than the latter. In dealing with individuals, the U.S. experience suggests the pharmacological approach, assisted with psychological techniques, would be the only effective method. Helms told the Warren Commission that while the Soviet drug research was extensive, it had consistently lagged about 5 years behind Western research. That was an interesting admission. For in the MKUltra files, which were declassified over a decade later, the CIA was using the Soviet success in mind control to motivate our own scientific program. Helms' memorandum told the commission the Soviets had adopted a multidisciplinary approach to mind control, integrating biological, social, and what he called physical mathematical research in attempts to control human behavior in a manner consistent with national plans. But while attempting to tell the Warren Commission what the Soviets were up to, Helms was, at the same time, revealing the cryptocracy's own intentions. His conclusion stated, "There is no evidence the Soviets had any techniques or agents capable of producing particular behavioral patterns which are not available in the West." Appended to the memorandum, Commission Document 113, were several hundred pages of reports on Soviet mind control techniques and an extensive bibliography on brainwashing, which for some reason remained classified even after the main body of the memorandum was declassified. The question of whether Oswald had been hypnoprogrammed was raised in another context when New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison began his independent investigations of the Kennedy assassination. Garrison told an anxious press he was going to crack the Kennedy case wide open. "The plain fact is that our federal intelligence agencies are implacably determined to do whatever is necessary to block any further inquiry into the facts of the assassination. The arrogant totalitarian efforts of these federal agencies to obstruct the discovery of the truth is a matter which I intend to bring to light when we have finished doing the job they should have done." One of the central targets of Garrison's investigation was David William Ferry, who was both a hypnotist and a CIA operative. Coincidentally, Ferry had been in a New Orleans Civil Air Patrol group in the 50s with Lee Harvey Oswald. One witness said Ferry had been the man who had instructed Oswald in marksmanship. When New Orleans police raided Ferry's apartment, they confiscated a number of weapons, various drugs, and three blank U.S. passports, things that any good CIA operative would keep at his elbow. Much later, research realized the importance of some of the evidence obtained in the raid. Several voluminous abstracts on post-hypnotic suggestion and a library on hypnotism. A salesman for the Equitable Life Insurance Company, Perry Raymond Russo, told a New Orleans grand jury that Ferry's apartment had been the scene of many parties where hypnosis had been used as entertainment. One evening, Russo said, Ferry hypnotized a young man to whom he apparently had a strong homosexual attraction. Another evening, Russo said, he himself hypnotized a young woman and made her immobile. He struck pins in her hand and burned her arms just to demonstrate the extent of her control he had over her. At Russo's request, his story was tested by Garrison's investigators. Under both sodium pentothal and hypnosis, Russo told the identical story to the identical story he had told the grand jury. He testified that he had been with Ferry, a man named Leon Oswald, and a third man named Clem Bertrand in Ferry's apartment during the summer of 1963. Three had discussed an assassination attempt in which diversionary tactics would be used. Russo quoted Ferry as saying there would have to be a minimum of three involved. Two of the persons would shoot diversionary shots and the third shoot the good shot. Ferry said one of the three would have to be the scapegoat. He also said Ferry discoursed on the availability of an exit, saying the sacrifice man would give the other two time to escape. On February 23, 1967, a few days before Luis Castillo was arrested by the FBI in the Philippines, Garrison subpoenaed David Ferry. That evening, George Lardner of the Washington Post went to Ferry's for an interview. Ferry, in remarkably good spirits, told Lardner, "A president is no better than anyone else. If I were killed, I expect my death to be investigated just as thoroughly." Lardner left Ferry at 4 a.m. 7 hours and 40 minutes later, Ferry was found in a bed with a sheet pulled over his head. He had been dead for several hours. On the dining room table was a note which read in part, "To leave this life is for me a sweet prospect. I find nothing in it that is desirable. On the other hand, everything that is loathsome." 15 empty medicine bottles littered the apartment. The medicinal bottles had contained a prescription drug for vascular disorder. Garrison immediately jumped to the conclusion that Ferry had committed suicide because of the subpoena. The autopsy, however, revealed Ferry had not died from an overdose of drugs, but from a ruptured blood vessel at the base of his brain. Dr. Ronald A. Walsh, Louisiana State University School of Medicine pathologist, stated in his autopsy report that David Ferry died of an aneurysm. Several forensic pathologists later concluded such an aneurysm could have been caused by a karate expert inflicting a blow to the back of the head in such a manner that no external damage would be discernible. A number of Ferry's friends began to fear for their lives. One, Jack Martin, came out of hiding long enough to suggest that Oswald had been programmed by Ferry to go by to Dallas and kill the president. Immediately following the assassination, Martin had reported to the assistant district attorney, Herman S. Coleman, that Ferry and Oswald had been friends, and that Ferry had instructed Oswald in the use of a telescope sight on a rifle. But in 1963, no one followed up on Martin's story. Another of Ferry's friends was a Reverend Raymond Brochures, who had roomed with Ferry 3 years before Ferry's death. Brochures stated in a television interview, "David admitted being involved with assassins. There's no question about that." The Warren Commission must have had some suspicions about Ferry, for in Volume 24, Exhibit 2038 of the Warren Commission report, NBC cameraman Gene Barnes is quoted as saying, "Bob Mulholland, an NBC News Chicago, talked in Dallas to one Ferry. Ferry said Oswald had been under hypnosis from a man doing a mind-reading act at Ruby's Carousel. Ferry was said to be a private detective and the owner of an airplane who took young boys on flights just for kicks." Evidence was later turned up that Ferry did own an airplane, and the evidence suggests he did work for Guy Bannister, the New Orleans private eye and CIA contract agent. Bob Mulholland later came forward to say that it had been misquoted by the Warren Report. What he had actually overheard were FBI agents saying Ferry might have been involved in the assassinations with Oswald. He had merely relayed that information to his reporters in Dallas. In any event, there was enough substance to the David Ferry angle to cause both the FBI and the Secret Service to interview him immediately following the assassination. Yet there were no reports, official or otherwise, as to the outcome of that interview. Those not disposed to believe in conspiracies against the American people by its own government might well ask, if there is a conspiracy by a cryptocracy, why wouldn't we by now have proof of it? Why wouldn't there have been at least one deathbed confession by one of the conspirators? Two such confessions to the JFK assassination conspiracy were made and ignored. David Ferry wore a wig and false eyebrows. He was well trained in hypnosis and may have used it to program Lee Harvey Oswald as the patsy he confessed to being. Thank you.